WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And with me now is Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel, who's just completed a biography of D.W. Griffith, the first major American narrative filmmaker, who created film techniques that have since become conventions of the form. Schickel is the author of several books, including the Disney version and Cary Grant, A Celebration. He's also written and produced several public television documentary series about movies, including The Men Who Made the Movies and Star Wars to Jedi, The Making of a Saga. He also did the documentary James Cagney, That Yankee Doodle Dandy, and for NBC he did the series Life Goes to the Movies. Schickel has been the film critic for Time since 1973 and previously served as Life magazine's film critic. His new book, D.W. Griffith, An American Life, is published by Simon & Schuster. We're going to talk about D.W. Griffith and then also talk about his film reviewing for Time magazine and other projects in the works. Richard Schickel, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Let's start off with D.W. Griffith's importance in film history. Maybe you can summarize
that
for us.
I think the simple way to say it is that he was probably the first person to come to movies as a self-conscious artist. I mean, not to say that people didn't occasionally commit a little art in the way of making these tiny little movies. I mean, movies were only when Griffith came to them in 1908. At most, say 10 to 12 minutes long, a reel in length. A lot of them were much shorter than that, obviously. And the most they did was tell a little visual anecdote of some kind. I mean, you wouldn't even perhaps dignify them by calling them a short story. But Griffith had been a not very distinguished actor for something over around a decade in the theater. He was a total failure as a playwright. And yet he was a very ambitious and energetic man. And at 33, I think when he drifted to the movies, as most people did in those days from the theater, looking for a few days' work, I think he quickly said, wait a minute, this is something you could take and form into an art. And I think he probably got very quickly the notion that he, being ambitious and single-minded and kind of intelligent about dramatic structure, that he could dominate this sort of art in a state of flux, not yet with any conventions by which it told stories or really appealed to people. I mean, really at this point, just the fact that there was some image on a screen that moved was close to being of sufficient interest to people. But Griffith really did have some literary ambitions. Got this notion, I think, that he could shape this medium in any way that he wanted to shape it, because there would be no basic opposition to anything he wanted to do. I mean, the people controlling the business at that juncture were people who were in it as a sort of small-scale businessmen. And whatever worked would work. They didn't care. They were really just interested in selling film by the foot and keeping the programs in the theaters they supplied changing on a sort of twice-a-week basis. What was on those programs was of less concern to them than that there was a change of program to provide. So it was a period of enormous freedom for Griffith, and with his ambition and with his flair, he very quickly, really in a matter of a year, reshaped movies such as they were at that time, so that he was telling fairly ambitious and complicated narratives, still in this short one-reel form, but doing little adaptations of, say, Poe short stories or pocket versions of Shakespearean plays or Jack London stories and novels. I mean, in other words, they were really he had an ambition to be, as we would now say, sort of classy with this new medium. And it was important for the medium that it become that.
What were some of the storytelling techniques that he developed that eventually became conventions of movies?
Well, you see, coming from the kind of theater he had come from, which was a melodramatic theater, with where possible, very powerful, spectacular elements. I mean, you know, all those conventions that we sort of laugh at, you know, the girl tied to the railroad track and the villain hanging over her and demanding the mortgage or her life. Those were actual situations from actual melodramas. And in the theater of that time, they would put railroad tracks down and a train would come tooting and hooting toward this poor prone body of the heroine. And maybe on the other side of the stage would be her lover galloping to her rescue on a horse on a treadmill. I mean, very complicated scenic effects were going on in the theater at that time. What I think Griffith, I think this is an important thing he noticed about the movies, is that they could do easily, optically, what the theater was doing with great difficulty mechanically. And so his drive was, when I say complex narrative, his drive was to put into these little films perhaps more than one narrative level, a little bit of a subplot, or at least the capacity to cut back and forth between, let's say, the imperiled heroine and, in fact, that was a classic Griffith situation. I don't recall he ever actually had anybody tied to a railroad track, but the heroine was often imperiled by burglars or anarchists or whoever, and the situation would be that someone had to come and rescue her. Well, the notion of cutting from the person in peril to the people racing through difficulties to rescue that person was a new thing, actually, in movies. And, of course, it increased people's subjective identification with both parties, cutting back and forth. That was important. He also quickly cottoned on to the notion that even though films were silent, that by coming closer and closer to the subjects in close-up and medium shot, by selecting out of the crowd of people in a scene a face here for a reaction, a face there for another reaction, that kind of selectivity, which had not been done in movies before, would, again, increase people's emotional involvement with the film. And more than that, you know, the cliche phrase that he did often utter was that we can photograph thought. And the business of bringing us, you know, that close to people so that you got a sense, even without voice, since these were silent film, you got a sense of what they were thinking, what they were feeling, became in very large measure a substitute for dialogue. So that was all of his technical innovations, and they were often not so much innovations as borrowings of other techniques, but then orchestrating them in a new way, in more original and more vivid ways than had previously been done. All of that was really in aid of his strong suit, which was narrative. I think he loved stories and storytelling, and that's where he was pressing this medium. So all the technique and technology for which he's often credited, and justifiably, really was there, arose out of the need to solve specific narrative problems as they occurred to him.
My guest is Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel, who's just written a new biography of D.W. Griffith. Now, he grew up in Kentucky, but he made most of his films in California, and that was before...
Well, actually, to correct you, I would say he made the majority of his films in New York. I mean, after all, the Biograph period, the one real period, some 400 films, the vast majority were shot in New York. What happened then, and he was not the only movie maker to do this, was they would go for the winter months to California in search of better weather and also more spacious scenery. I mean, Los Angeles was very useful for movie makers in those days because within literally trolley car rides, there was the beach, the mountains, the desert, and an urban environment and suburban environment in downtown Los Angeles and in the growing suburban centers outside of it, one of which was, of course, Hollywood. But he went there only intermittently. He then went for a brief period. Then he came back east where he established his own megalomaniac studio and made a lot of films there. So probably, on balance, he did make more films in New York than he did in Los Angeles. But there's no question that he was a distinctly a pioneer of making pictures in Los Angeles. People had preceded him there, but not by many years. And not with as great distinction, I should think.
Was there a center of the film industry then, during the period of silent films?
I would think that until, well, say about 1915 to 20 is when the shift decisively occurred between the shift from New York as the production center to Los Angeles as a production center. More and more people decided, I think, to stay on in the pleasant weather in Los Angeles and skip the problems that are inherent in working in a bustling and urban environment like New York. Of course, you must remember the financial center of the industry remained basically in New York until our own time, and it's still to some measure there.
Probably his most controversial film is Birth of a Nation, which was about Klansmen.
Mm-hmm.
Before we talk about the controversy around it and the protests against the film, maybe you can give us a capsule of the story.
Oh, to capsulize that story is really very difficult. Begin by saying it is based on a famous novel called The Klansmen by Thomas Dixon, who was much more an ideological racist than Griffith was. Griffith was a Southerner, and he was a man of his time, an American man of his time, which meant that he had a great deal of semi and unconscious racism in his nature, I'm afraid. Sorry to say. But Dixon was something else again. I mean, he was a real racial ideologue, and I find a most unpleasant human being at every level. But anyway, it had been an extraordinarily popular novel at the turn of the century, and then Dixon had adapted it for the stage, and it had been not in the large urban centers, but out around the country in the smaller cities, especially in the South, obviously, an enormously popular success. So it is the story, as Griffith told it, of two families, a northern and a southern family, most of the focus on the southern family, who were friends prior to the Civil War. Their sons actually meet in a really touching and tragic moment on the battlefield in a beautifully shot Civil War engagement that Griffith concocted. And the first half of the film, up to the intermission, which was planned, and it was a film over 2 hours in length, it's really a kind of a wonderful and touching portrait of a nation sort of riven by civil war. I mean, there's nothing actually morally objectionable in the first half of that film. The second half is quite a different story because in Reconstruction days, carpetbaggers and scallywags, you know, put blacks into positions of political power in the South. It certainly implied that the Northern occupying army treated the South like a conquered province. This was very much in the mythology of the South in which Griffith had been a boy. I don't want to seem to be justifying Griffith's choices in this matter, but most of the historiography of the time followed the notion of this tragic era of Reconstruction in which, with the martyred President Lincoln dead, the North indulged itself in a riot of repressiveness and the imposition of blacks upon the previously white supremacist society in the South. Most of this now modern historians have discounted, but at that time the notion of a tragic era in Southern American history was very powerful and very respectable, unfortunately, and Griffith worked off of that. He always claimed to have consulted the historical sources. But what we have in it is two young women of this in this film, one the daughter of the northern family who is imprisoned by a mulatto lieutenant governor of a southern state and asked to choose between a forced marriage and death, in the other case, the daughter of the southern family actually being threatened with rape by a black man and throwing herself off a cliff and through, as the subtitle has it, the opal gates of death rather than submit to this dishonor at the hands of the black man. Both of these are highly charged sexual melodramatic incidents in the film, and that's, of course, where the controversy stems from, other than the fact that the group attempting to rescue particularly Lillian Gish playing the threatened northern lady, is the Ku Klux Klan. And we see in the hero, the son, the scion of the southern family, we see him concocting, organizing the Klan and sewing up bedsheets for them and all the rest of it. The Klan is presented as a heroic force for justice in this situation. I mean, it is to modern eyes a horror to see this. I mean, and the point to be made is you were asking about California. I would think that this picture might have had a different form entirely had it been made in the East. But isolated as Griffith was at that time in Los Angeles, he was unaware of the NAACP, which had come into existence in 1912 and which would lead the fight against this film, and which for which it would be actually a strangely a heaven-sent opportunity. It was a very big an approachable public issue, this racist movie. And it became an issue that it could rally its forces and around and find allies for in the white liberal community. It was a very important issue for the NAACP. I think it was the issue that made the NAACP into a social force in this country. I must say to you that until the NAACP really began a serious campaign against the film, which included bringing it into court, bringing it in before various licensing bodies and city councils, trying to get it stopped or edited. Until that happened, most of the reviews of the film really took it just as the best movie melodrama ever made. There was very little comment on its racist implications. Obviously, the American public responded to it. Griffith, in a matter of years, I think his take out of the film probably amounted to something like $5 million. That is, his corporation's take out of the film was something like $5 million. In other words, this picture grossed about $50 million in 1914 dollars in this country, or 1914 to 18 dollars. So that's you're talking Star Wars, literally the Star Wars of the time. It would have, today it would have grossed in say $200 or $300 million.
There's since been many films that have been the target of political protests by groups who found them very offensive. What were some of the techniques the NAACP did?
I found this film. It's offensive to modernize. I think you have to, in part, excuse Griffith. He was unfortunately. See, we expect of great artists that they have a social imagination as large as their aesthetic imagination. Unfortunately, he did not. And he was very too much like his fellow countrymen at that moment. One would have been much happier writing this book if one had seen in him leadership instead of being just one of the crowd on this issue. But he was not vouchsafed that ability.
So did the NAACP try boycotts or try to get the film out of distribution?
Definitely. Boycotts, which were ineffective. Actually thinking about Indiana Jones and, everybody fussing about this, is it too violent for children to see? Well, when a film develops that kind of must-see momentum, I mean, you might as well forget about the boycott. You know what? Everybody's going to go see Indiana Jones, whatever, and I think most of the discussion of it is nonsense, but once that gets going, there's no point. You might as well step back, step aside from the tidal wave and let it wash over you because the folks are going to go see it no matter what your moral objections are to it. They were ineffective in all their boycotts. They were ineffective in most of their attempts to get the most riveting scenes taken from the film. One thing I should say, and it's important in understanding all of D.W. Griffith's work, is that there was one situation that was riveting for him, and that was the innocent child woman in some way imperiled by the bestial male. I mean, he's always working his material around to a situation like that. It was, a psychosexual issue with Griffith that was very important to him. I mean, he obviously saw in himself elements of this rapacious maleness, which he hid under a cloak of gentility and so forth. In other words, you have to realize the Victorian sensibility, and we're beginning to get a sense in the last decade or two by, academic studies of Victorian pornography of just how what a can of worms lay underneath the cloak of Victorian respectability there was. So Griffith was that. And I think in his nature, I mean, he very frequently had affairs with his very young actresses. That was the dark side of his own nature. The good side of it was that of a sort of a genial and intelligent mentor to young people, both men and women. But the dark side of his nature was what kind of crept out in movies like Birth of a Nation. In other words, I would say that for him, blackness in the context of this movie was much more a symbol of not of racial horrors, but of male horrors, and black as a symbolic color had a deep and profound and finally unanalyzable appeal to him, that blackness in the male nature. But it's film after film. He never put them in blackface after this movie. But film after film has males behaving as the black men behave in Birth of a Nation. It was much, much more of interest to him than the racial issue, I think.
He took some of his $5 million in profits and put it into the film Intolerance, which
yeah, a couple hundred
lost
thousand
a good deal
dollars
of money.
He did lose a fairly substantial sum of money on Intolerance, maybe up to around $200,000. It's kind of hard to figure all that out. I mean, movie economics are always kind of a dicey business. But yeah, he went on immediately thereafter. See, he'd had a nice little film in the work called The Mother in the Law, which was a modest 4 or 5 reel, very good movie. That's in the heart of Intolerance. But after the great success of Birth, he didn't feel he could just come out with a modest little modern, what amounted to a gangster and labor union dispute melodrama. So he decided to tack all this other stuff onto it. So we get the Babylonian sequence, and there's a sequence of French Huguenots being massacred on St. Bartholomew's Eve. And there's a, as there always is when show business gets a little desperate, there's the, you know, the Christ story mixed into this. So there are these 4 stories of intolerance as it was worked out through the ages, and people victimized by other people's intolerance of their views. I should say the reason he chose this theme was that he felt that the attempts to censor Birth of a Nation represented an intolerable act of intolerance against him and his views. He really did believe that he had the right, which is true, to express whatever opinion he had, and that the censorious impulse was wrongly addressed to him. So, I mean, this was never, as many people have argued, an apologia for Birth of a Nation. It was, if anything, a response to what he regarded as unfair intellectual treatment of his work. It's a little preposterous when you stop to think about it.
Why do you think it was such a failure?
Well, I think because the intercutting of 4 narratives interferes with audience identification with any one group of the characters. I mean, you're just kind of settling back and getting interested in one group, and whap, you know, you're cut away to Babylon, and then you're back over in, you know, 16th century France, and then you're back over in biblical Judea, and then you're back to the United States. I mean, both the Babylonian and the and he did, he cut them apart a few years later and released Mother-in-Law and the Babylonian sequence separately. Each of them was long enough to be about an hour feature apiece. That didn't appreciably help him economically. But the necessity of sort of the enveloping narrative that takes you up, transports you to another time, place, or situation, and then holds you there, that enveloping quality is very important in, I think, all fictional forms. And I think to keep breaking it in this way, though it's a wonderful radical idea and certainly worth the experiment, does not work in this particular film. And indeed, no other film that I know of has ever attempted this, as he called it, fugal form. And I think with good reason. It really does not work. It's interesting. The picture opened rather strongly. It opened as strongly and often more strongly than Birth of a Nation. His reputation had preceded him. People were interested in it. It got extraordinarily good reviews in the big urban centers. But it had no legs. I mean, the folks really didn't hear hear good word of mouth on this picture, and its take quickly dwindled. picture only really did cost about $350,000 to make. It was not the $2 million that people have ascribed often to it. I actually found where that came from. They found a reporter from Scientific American, and they cooked up a fake set of books and said it in front of him. Look, this is what the accounting department says, $1,900,000. And he printed that, and it's gone on through movie history ever since. But in the papers at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, there's a legitimate set of accounting books that indicates that, you know, costs around $350,000 plus prints and advertising after that. So I would say he lost a couple hundred thousand out of it ultimately.
Well, after Intolerance, he did go on to have several more successes. But,
oh, yeah.
But he ended his career in a state of failure. What happened? Do you think that sound movies displaced him?
No, I would think what happened is he then went off to England and with some support from the British government made Hearts of the World, which was really propaganda designed to try and bring the United States into the war. Unfortunately, as he arrived in England, the United States declared war on Germany, so its function then became simply patriotic fervor in this country. The picture was successful financially. He made a series of six short and charming pictures for Adolf Zukor's Art Craft Company, but he really wanted to have a studio of his own. And he bought a rich man's estate near Mamaroneck in New York. It was an estate that actually belonged to a robber baron, a man who'd been associated with Rockefeller and the establishment of Standard Oil. So he buys this lavish estate and creates a movie studio on it with enormous problems in so doing. He was undercapitalized. He, as an independent, did not have access to the capital markets, which the major studios were beginning to have at that point. And he was profligate. I mean, it was a D.W. Griffith film and nothing but the best for D.W. Griffith. And he had enormous success with the first film that was really fully shot on that at that studio, which was Way Down East, which again was an adaptation of a famous theatrical melodrama of 20 or 30 years prior to that. But he was unable to make any more pictures as successful. Now, it is a myth to think that people did not like Griffith's films in the 20s. By and large, they grossed very well. Trouble was that the costs were very high, and had he been able to make these pictures at a more modest scale, he would have showed a profit, and he would have been able to keep his studio open. But he really was really kind of movie nuts at that point. I mean, Miss Dempster was one of his later loves, and later leading ladies would come in and say, well, you know, I mean, it doesn't have the big Griffith finish on it. And the next thing you know, he was spending $250,000 extra dollars to give her a storm sequence that would be roughly the equivalent of the famous storm sequence at the end of Way Down East. And, of course, a picture that would have been profitable, it was immediately turned into a picture that was a disastrous loss for him. So, and the whole tendency of the industry was toward real industrialized production, with many pictures at various stages of production at a single studio, of providing programs for its theater chain and chains associated with it. Griffith, as an independent, couldn't really function in that changing industrial atmosphere. So that's the biggest problem. Lost the studio within a matter of 4 or 5 years. Went to work first for Zukor at Paramount and then for Joe Skank at something called the Art Cinema, which released through United Artists, which was a company that Griffith had helped found. And in none of those, he was by this time incapable of working as anybody's employee, even though he had enormous independence even so. I mean, it mustn't be thought that, I mean, Miss Gish, for example, at that time gave out interviews saying he's toiling in chains for the film trust. Well, I mean, they were velvet chains. I mean, they were rich contracts. He was much indulged by the people who ran those studios. The point was, he was a man in his 50s. He'd suffered a terrible loss. He could see that he could never act in the grand seniorial manner that he had been used to acting in. And then, as you suggest, sound film came in, which really put the entire industry in an uproar. And for Griffith, by this time now, a marginal and difficult character for the studios to handle. And with all the problems they were having with sound, could the famous silent picture director handle sound and so forth? Actually, his first sound picture he made, too, was really quite good. It was Abraham Lincoln, Walter Houston as Lincoln. I find it one of his of his later works, one of his more pleasant works. I mean, it's kind of mythic Lincoln, but it's a very sweet-spirited movie, and it's really no worse than, in many respects, as good as John Ford's Young Mr. Lincoln or Abe Lincoln in Illinois. I mean, it's an excellent kind of sweet, kind of naive movie. I mean, it wouldn't compare with Gore Vidal's novel about Lincoln that's just been published, but it was a very agreeable and visually very handsome film. I think he could have functioned if he could have found a way psychologically to function in this changed industry. I think as a director, as a craftsman, he could have functioned. I think he kept turning away opportunities in the 30s. I think he really enjoyed the notion of himself as a tragic figure.
Can you just tell us briefly how your opinions of him as a person and of his work changed in the decade that you researched?
Well, I think you begin. Here's a biography that no one had attempted in any serious way. There had been a couple of books about Griffith, but not very good ones. And I think all of us who were involved in movies have seen him as a heroic figure, the first artist of the movies and then the first artist betrayed by the unfeeling industry. As I've just indicated, I think his fate is much more complicated than that, and it much more has to do with self-destructive as much has to do with self-destructive impulses within himself, blind spots, prejudices, and so forth within himself. So the notion of writing this simple and heroic tale of a movie pioneer, an artist hero of the industry and of the art, does not hold up under investigation. So then you have to re-examine your premises somewhat. I have great sympathy for Griffith. I have great sympathy for anybody conducting in public a complicated career in a form of work that is itself in the process of formation. I mean, that is a mind-bending course to try and navigate. So I have sympathy with him. He was a bit of a humbug and a bit of a old-fashioned showman and a kind of, in his public statements at least, rather grandiloquent and in a kind of old-fashioned matinee idol sense. I mean, people have asked me what I think he's like. I say Albert Finney in The Dresser, you know, that sort of grand 19th century matinee idol manner in public, a lot of false humility combined with a lot of egocentricity. So he's not quite the tragic figure that we think he is, but in that sense, he's a much more interesting figure and a much more complex figure. So that's how my mind changed about him. Things like Birth of a Nation, I think, you have to think very hard and seriously about that. And, for a man of, you know, this era of my temperament and sensibilities, I mean, that's a hard one to get over. So that presents problems, I think, to all biographers. A lot of people started on biographies of Griffith, but so far I'm the only one who's finished one that, you know, deserves to be taken at all seriously, that is based on original sources and all of that.
My guest is Richard Schickel, who has written a new biography of D.W. Griffith. It's titled D.W. Griffith, An American Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Richard Schickel is also the film critic for Time magazine. You've been with Time since 1973.
Isn't that amazing?
How influential do you think of your reviews as being?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's manifest that Time, along with Newsweek, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the so-called national press, is influential in some measure on movies. But I don't think any of us have ever calculated what the nature of that influence is. I mean, no matter what the judgment of Time or any of these publications is on a picture like Indiana Jones, for example, it's not going to materially affect its performance at the box office. On the other hand, I think maybe we can occasionally help sort of the worthy foreign film, the modest, perhaps independently made American film, or the troubled American film that the studio is not behind but which we critically find meritorious. I mean, I think we can help those pictures a little, but so often I find that we at Time have, you know, praised a film that's excellent. Other people have joined in the praise, and the thing still dies a dreadful death at the box office. I don't know. I think sometimes if by accident a bunch of influential critics get behind a given picture. MASH was a good example of that picture. The studio had very little faith in, but everybody in New York in that critical community, they just loved this movie. This is now 14 years ago or so. And somehow those reviews turned the tide for that movie. There are probably a few other instances like that one could cite, but more often than not, you don't get that kind of agreement in the critical community, and I think that's what's essential. Two or three good reviews, no matter how weighty the source of those reviews, won't do it. It's when 10 or 12 happen. And then this thing that we're talking about with Griffith, the fact is if those reviews can get a kind of core audience going and that core audience comes out and says, that was great, I really loved it, and tells their friends, then that movie will go. But that's a very chancy piece of business to get all those elements going in just the right way.
You do frequently write about foreign films and sometimes about independent films. Does Time have any guidelines about when a film is considered too esoteric for you to include in there?
No, I don't think so. The problem is always is space. We are not like the New York Times, a newspaper of record. They review or may attempt at least to get a paragraph or two in on absolutely every movie that opens in the city of New York, be it a movie playing in the Whitney Museum of Modern Art, or whether it's playing at a 42nd Street grindhouse. I mean, they will make that attempt. We can't do that. I mean, we have at most 3, 4, maybe when we're very lucky, 5 columns of review space per issue, and sometimes we don't have any review space. So it's picking and choosing. There are no guidelines. And I think we would be actually encouraged if we found a really sort of flaky, esoteric movie that we liked that at least was going to get released. I mean, the only real standard is you have to have some kind of release in the United States. There's no point in reviewing movies in the abstract. That is to say, if our readers haven't even the faintest hope of ever seeing it, we can't really justify using the space. But as long as it's playing somewhere, we'll take a whack at it.
You share the film reviews with Richard Corliss at Time. I bet that people come up to you all the time. I can't remember which were
Well,
Rich,
unfortunately, we have the same first name. Right. I mean, I've shared that space through the years with two other people, Frank Rich and Jay Cox. And it's more of a problem with us because of the Richard thing. I think we actually have quite different tastes in movies and quite different approaches to movies. So I think most people get a sense of who's who if they read us more or less regularly. The casual reader might easily confuse, though.
How do you decide who's going to review which?
I don't know. We've never really formalized that. Things like vacation schedules come into it. This very week, Richard has been at the Festival of Cannes, and he was able to see the full 4-hour foreign version of Once Upon a Time in America, and he also was able to see, or had seen, I guess, before he left, the short American release version of it. So he will write about that because he's had access to the two versions of it. So accidents of that kind come into it. Sometimes preference. I mean, you know, one or the others will say, I would really like to review this movie for whatever weird subjective reason we might have. But other times it's kind of what we do is 5 or 6 times a year sit down with a list of the major forthcoming movies and try to fairly divide those up. Very often that doesn't work out exactly fairly because, you know, what looks like in February, a terrific big May release may turn out to be a big bomb, and some picture you didn't really calculate on has turned out to be an enormous success. So there has to be a certain amount of variance. And then there's just the smaller pictures that we don't really predict in advance or choose in advance. And then that becomes kind of like, well, I'm free this weekend. I'll take a look at it. It's much less formal than people sort of from the outside think of it as being.
The crop of summer films has started to hit the theaters. What do you think of the current crop? Summer movies are always very, very light and
well, summer movies, yes. It's just the time of year when you wish you were, you know, still in your teens because, I mean, really that's what the core audience for summer movies is, and they're movies that are being made for that audience. Of the lot, I mean, to me, to my taste, the picture I like best is Ghostbusters. I think that's a really funny farce. I think Bill Murray really establishes himself as a major, major movie figure. I mean, he's been wonderful in a lot of sort of weird little movies, and then Marvelous and Tootsie, of course, last year. But I think this is going to be a biggie. I think it's just a movie with good spirit, good fun in it. It's well acted. It just works in some funny way. And I think, you know, who's not going to like it? I mean, I think an adult can have a good time in it. I think kids will have a good time. It's not too, too scary. It's kind of funny scary. But it's suspenseful and it works. I think that's probably the surprise movie of the year, because there had been rumors that the picture was kind of troubled and maybe wasn't going to be the big – I think it probably, because it was troubled, started sailing up over budget, that kind of thing. But I think it's going to come out to be a major success.
Robert Redford's film, The Natural, is based on a Bernard Malamud novel, which is completely changed in the telling in the movie. Do you have objections to when an ending of failure is, like in the novel, is turned into an ending of incredible success?
I'm not sure.
Like
the novel is wonderfully ambiguous on whether or not that's a success or a failure, because in fact, morally, he's as successful as if he'd hit the home run, because morally, he has determined The Natural to go all out and try and win this ball game. In fact, he strikes out, but that's not his fault. Morally, he was trying, so he's still, in that sense, a moral winner, but an obvious loser in the game. Yeah, I think with the Malamud novel, and here I bring a certain prejudice to that. I really love that novel of Malamud's. I think it's his best novel. I think it has a wonderful mysterious quality to it, yet a wonderful ease to it as well as a novel. And I think the movie errs by forcing up sort of the magical aspects of it. I mean, if you read the Malamud novel, it's there, but it is so lightly touched upon, the nature of this magic bat and all of that. I mean, the mythic aspects of the novel are so delicately handled. The movie comes thumping at you with all of that, you know, the tree split by lightning and every aspect of it is forced at the mythic level. And I think that is almost worse than the ending of the novel, where, in fact, instead of striking out, The Natural hits the game-winning home run. I could almost accept that more easily than I can this constant, you know, heavy-handed strumming on the mythic themes that just Malamud so lightly plucked. So I don't like that about it. I think it's a well-performed movie. I mean, I think Redford's good. I think most of the supporting cast is very good in it. I don't like the look of the movie in general. I mean, there's a sort of self-conscious 30s, I don't know, depression photographer's hopper painting kind of atmosphere to the movie that I don't care greatly for either.
My guess is Richard Schickel, film critic for Time magazine and author of a new biography of D.W. Griffith. Are there movies that you've seen during your lifetime that you measure all new movies against because they're so good?
No, I don't think that. I think you have a sense of maybe 50 or 100 movies that in some way or other you think of as wonderful works in the form. I would say that you might use something out of those lists for generic comparisons. I mean, you say, well, Sturgis did a situation like this and he did it better or different or more entertainingly or more interestingly, or conceivably you might even say this does something Sturgis or Lubitsch or Howard Hawks or somebody did in the past, only takes and does it better. So I think you have to bring a little bit of historical perspective to reviewing, sure. Maybe not too much of it. I mean, eras change, conventions of storytelling in movies change, really the nature of what you can and cannot put on a screen changes from decade to decade. The preoccupations of the audience changes from decade to decade. A lot of things go into it. The industrial structure changes. The kind of people who make movies has actually changed. I mean, really up until 15 years ago or so, most movies were not directed by college-educated people. Today they are for the most part, directed by such people. I mean, well, that changes a little bit the nature. It changes the nature of their aspirations, and it changes the nature of what they think is good and what is bad aesthetically. All that works into it. But, I mean, it's kind of a nice, rich mix to draw on. I think you must bring some historical perspective to it, else you're always going to be making discoveries that turn out not to be discoveries. I mean, if somebody's done it before and done it better, or maybe even influenced something, you have to be alert enough to be able to note that, I think.
Who are some of the filmmakers now that you think are emerging as being very important directors who will have an influence on movies in the future?
I don't know. The movies are no longer a young art. I mean, really, even into the 50s, you could say, well, movies are young art. I mean, they're only 50, at most 40 years old at that time, let's say, as a self-conscious art, that definition I used before in talking about DW. I'm not sure, though, that there's going to be somebody who will come along and like Griffith or Eisenstein or the whole group of German expressionists of the 20s or, let's say, the people who've then founded the sound film convention, sort of people like Lubitsch and maybe Orson Welles, who kind of summarized a lot of sound film convention in 1940 with Citizen Kane. I'm not sure there's going to be a figure exactly like those in, I mean, there will be obviously important and influential movie directors. But of the group presently practicing, I mean, there's obvious talent in somebody like Steven Spielberg. I think George Lucas had enormous talent as a director, but he chooses not to direct. I mean, but I think there's real gift in American Graffiti and in Star Wars 1. I think Brian De Palma and Martin Scorsese both have something kind of odd and singular to bring to movies, though I don't think either of them has yet done a kind of a fully fashioned masterpiece. I mean, there's enormous talent there, but there's sort of scattered in some way.
But what about Taxi Driver?
I like that less than many people do. I mean, I sort of respect it. I like where he was going with that. And I like Scorsese's interest in sort of the celebrity system and the way that works. It's a subject that interests me. That and the picture last year,
King of Comedy.
King of Comedy. I think both had very interesting material, and they're both flawed at some point. Both flawed kind of at the end. I mean, they were pretty good up until a certain point, each of them. Coppola has made, obviously, good films. Jonathan Demme, whose Swing Shift is currently in release and isn't so good, but it isn't. The picture was, I think, taken away from him. He's a man of talent. I mean, Melvin and Howard and Citizen's Band are both very interesting Sturgesian movies, I think. There's a lot of talent around, but I'm not sure we're in an era where someone is going to take and just move the movies forward in the way that, let's say, Eisenstein moved on from Griffith. You know, I mean, there was a whole new level of, let's say, editorial sophistication in the Eisenstein epics that built on Griffith's foundations but far transcended anything Griffith could do. Well, I'm not sure we're at a stage at this juncture where we're at some takeoff stage for the next sort of epical change in movies, if indeed that will ever come.
Well, do you think that some change is happening because of like made-for-TV movies and then the home market for movies after they're shown in theaters and they're shown on cable and then at home on video cassettes? Because the scale is so different.
Like, the scale
movies
is
are really
different.
Doubling on the big screen and then the small television.
That's true. The scale is different. And often movies that you loathe in the theater are kind of acceptable on the home screen. I find more often than not, when I see something on television, I'm prepared to indulge it when I would not indulge it in a theater on a big screen. That's perfectly true. And yet it seems to me that the films that have been the most successful with the audience on the home screen have been the big movies made primarily for theatrical release. The made-for-TV movies that have worked, let's say on the commercial networks, have either been sort of titillating in their subject matter. I mean, you can title them with a good, title, Cry Rape or something like that, or they have been triumphs of the human spirit. I mean, we're now far into the Roman numbers. Triumph of the human spirit, XXIV. Those kind of movies seem to work. And they have nothing to do with movies. They're really truly television forms. I think they will stay in television. There's been some attempt to actually make those kind of movies for the theaters, and they don't work there. Somehow they work on television. I'm interested that, say, Home Box Office has not had success in terms of its ratings and its general consumer acceptance with its own made-for-TV move, made-for-home box office movies. What people still want is that sense of you're getting something free here. You're getting some other sucker went out and paid $5 for in the movie, and I'm sitting here and I'm seeing it free. Somehow that is important. And I think even the sense that as you watch it, you understand you're not seeing the full scope of this film, that it's been, you know, panned and scanned to fit on television and all that. It doesn't make any difference. You do have a sense of there's even more here than meets the eye as you watch this film. And I think that is important in our response to those movies. So I'm not sure that for all the home videoing and whatnot that's going on, that it's actually going to change in the immediate future the sort of intrinsic nature of movies.
I feel cheated a lot when I go to the movies because the sound isn't loud enough and the screen isn't big enough.
Oh, I will tell you that the exhibition of movies in this country is an undiscussed scandal. I mean, I can't tell you how many movies that I have seen in a theater and felt, you know, they put the wrong mat on. So that the aspect ratio that the director intended is not there. Or you see, as you say, you hear bad sound, or you see movies blown up or down out of all proportion. I mean, it's preposterous. You just see bad projection. I mean, the arcs in the projector are so feeble they can't, you know, throw the image with sufficient clarity and definition onto the screen down at the other end of the room. I mean, it's all terrible. And what we put up with in movies, we would not put up with in other aspects of life because movies are this kind of mystery to us. But in fact, the educated consumer could really do a service by learning that, you know, there are. You don't have to sit there with their heads cut off. The projectionist can put a different mat in his projector and show you the heads of those people. You just have to know that he can do that and ask the manager, please, to show the thing in the proper size. You know, people really got to get a little smart about that. I don't think we should lie down and take movie exhibition at the level it's mostly practiced.
But a lot of the problem is the design of the theater itself. The screens have been doubled and quadrupled, and the chairs are at an angle askew to the screen.
Yep.
And even if you have good projection and decent sound, you're still not getting that feeling of being surrounded by the movie.
I think it's a good idea, again, as a consumer, to find the three or four theaters where you know that a picture is going to be played in something like its proper form and patronize those movies. You know, if you go in and see a big curved screen that's made for 70 millimeter and you're in there seeing a movie that's not made for 70 millimeter, there's very little point in going to that movie. You're going to see whatever is shown on it, unless by chance it is a 70 millimeter picture, in a disastrous form.
The movie theaters are, for the most part, I think, getting worse and not better in their design. Do you see anything in the future that might reverse that? You read things like, I think it was even in Time magazine I read it, that the trend in the future is going to be small dinner theaters for movies where you have cocktails and dinner. And
well,
I don't know about
dinner theaters for movies, but you do see these, you know, now. The notion of the twin has dropped down to sort of screening room sizes. I mean, there are shopping centers that will have 12 movies in them, but each auditorium will be for 50 or 60 people. Well, I don't mind that. Actually, not a bad way to see most movies. That's the way, obviously, I or most professional critics see most movies, is in a relatively small space that will seat less than 100 people, but with excellent projection. Now, if those weren't all automated situations, if you were seeing those in with excellent equipment, that would be close to an ideal way to see a movie, most movies. I mean, you wouldn't want to see Star Wars in one of those little rinky-dink theaters, but the typical movie would be well shown in such a theater.
We only have about a minute left, but what would you suggest if you are at a theater where you can tell that the projection's bad or the sound should be louder?
Yeah, I go out, and first you ask the usher, who will say there's nothing he can do about it, and then he will say, then I must see the manager, and then you will find the manager, and he will have whatever excuse he has. But sometimes an adjustment can be made. Sometimes a projectionist is just, you know, being a union employee is just goofing off up there. But I think it's important that a sort of steady stream of people go and knowledgeably, and not violently, but knowledgeably complain about the quality of what they paid perfectly good money to see. I don't know why you should be assaulted with the commercials in movies either. I mean, you've paid money. It's not free like television. And then they're showing you commercials for various products. I mean, I find that loathsome. I mean, that's a jip. I think, you know, an educated consumer is the best friend of movies. And I think that's a very important thing for people to realize that they can do and should do. You can just go and say, hey, you know what? It looks a little murky to me. And maybe it only means that his arcs need adjusting or something like that that can be quickly fixed. Okay. But then you could also say, I ain't coming back here until this, you get some decent projection in this theater and make it stick. I don't see why you shouldn't do that. I mean, movies are not so prosperous they can afford to turn away customers, you know.
Yeah. Well, I guess at the movie chains, everybody's an employee. Nobody feels like they have a real vested interest in.
I guess so. I guess so. But even so, I think it should be possible to. Anyway, you have to be rudely handled by ushers at a theater or anything like that. I mean, sort of stand up and be counted.
Okay. Well, on that note, it's really been fun to talk with you. Thanks a lot for being here.
Enjoyed it.